Millions of Muslims mourn on Ashura, commemorating the historic Battle of Karbala and its message of resistance against injustice and tyranny. Truckloads of fuel arrive in Gaza hours after Islamic Jihad agrees to a ceasefire, ending 3 days of deadly Israeli air raids. Plus, the UN chief raises the alarm over the risk of nuclear confrontation on the anniversary of the first atomic bombing by the U.S. nearly 8 decades ago. Good to have you with us. Now, millions of mourners turning out in different cities across Iran to mark Ashura, the martyrdom anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. Every year, black clad mourners mark the occasion by mourning processions and ceremonies held at mosques. The rituals involve beating on their chests and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. Ashura is the 10th day of the lunar calendar month of Muharram. It's the day when Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were martyred on the plains of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They were killed by forces of the tyrannical ruler of the time in the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD. Hassan Mehdi Torabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institution in Iran, earlier told us about the message of Karbala for generations now.
When we look at what happened, this event, this martyrdom, this struggle, on one level, it's reminding us, and it wants to remind humanity until the end, what it actually means to be a human being. Because this is something that's in our time, something that's, you know, there's so much confusion about it. We see that there's confusion in the world about what it actually means to be a human. What I mean by that is, is being human simply the sum of the material existence of humans and all the needs that one might have in terms of the material needs? Or is there more to humanity? Is there more to being a human being than simply those material needs that then, you know, become what guides you in life, as opposed to the definition of a human being something more than that, including aspects that are beyond this world, including values that are not simply about satisfying that short-term needs that you might have, or the short-term interest that you might have from one day to another or from 1 year to another, but the definition of what it means to actually be a successful human being, based on the real meaning of what it means to be a human being, which is an eternal existence. Human beings are eternal existences. They're not things that end after 70, 80, 90, 100 years. You know, we have this illusion that now that we have advanced so much, and, you know, I'm all in favor of advancement, I'm all in favor of science, I'm all in favor of using the material tools that the universe offers us to advance humanity and to advance the welfare of humanity. So it's not this kind of, you know, simple black and white issue. But in this process, we should not forget what the real definition of a human being is, which is that human beings are eternal existences.
Authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have attacked the Muharram procession in the region's capital city of Srinagar. As Stress TV correspondent reports, a number of mourners have been injured and dozens more got arrested while performing the traditional procession.
Scores of people were injured and many more were arrested after government forces attacked Muharram mourners in the Indian-controlled Kashmir's main city, Srinagar. Authorities had placed strict restrictions in the city and sealed the entry points with barbed wires to prevent Shia Muslims from participating in the traditional procession. On Saturday evening, authorities issued a statement upholding a ban on mourning processions in the city centre. Police and paramilitary forces were deployed in big numbers to maintain order. Mobile internet services were suspended in parts of Srinagar. However, some mourners defied restrictions and poured onto the streets at many places to mourn the martyrdom of Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein. The government forces swung into action and hit people with canes. A number of mourners were also detained.
3 decades on, the authorities continue to prevent Shia Muslims from holding traditional Muharram procession in the region's city center, citing security reasons. The people here argue if the government can allow Hindu processions and political rallies in the heart of the city, why not Muharram procession?
See, on one hand, we see the whole security mechanism, you know, they get activated when Hindu pilgrimages are granted permissions and security arrangements are being made. But on the other hand, we see when, you know, something related to Muslims is there. They don't grant permissions. We don't want security at the first place. We want permission so that we could carry out our religious activities.
Very recently, ruling BJP party held a political rally in the city center. If authorities can ensure security for that rally, why are our peaceful morning processions banned? Why this discrimination?
Two major Muharram processions in the city center were banned by authorities following the outbreak of militancy in Kashmir in 1989. The authorities fear the processions could be taken advantage of by separatist groups to stoke anti-India sentiments and hence create security threats. The religious bodies, on the other hand, term the ban as a brazen attack on their religious freedom.
It is very unfortunate that the authorities are selectively banning religious activities of the majority population here, shutting down mosques and banning processions, even as authorities claim the situation is improving in Kashmir. These days, annual Hindu pilgrimage is underway in Kashmir and all sorts of arrangements are being made to facilitate that. We strongly condemn discriminatory behavior of the government and hope that the good sense will prevail.
The religious bodies have also criticized the authorities for failing to make necessary arrangements, like ensuring availability of essential supplies. They say all promises and claims made by the authorities have fallen flat. Sidri Safi, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
A thousand people have held a rally in the Yemeni capital Sana'a that on the occasion of Ashura, and they are also praising Palestinians' resistance in Gaza during the recent Israeli strikes. So political analyst Yusuf Mara is now with us and is going to give us an update on the situation in Sana'a. Yusuf, over to you.
Yes, well, what's very interesting about this year's Ashura commemoration in Yemen, in the capital, which took place in the capital Sana'a and in various other Yemeni provinces, what's interesting is that the main theme was not necessarily focused about the plight of the Yemeni people and the struggle of the Yemeni people, considering the fact that the country has been at war for 7 years. The main focus and the main theme of this commemoration was the struggle of the Palestinian people. And speakers at the event declared that the Yemeni people will always stand side by side with the Palestinian resistance and with their right to defend their land against the what they call the Israeli despotic occupation of the Palestinian lands. The other theme of the protest was Islamic unity. And speakers at the event from the Ansar Allah movement basically called for Islamic unity within the masses of the Muslim population globally. And they declared that unification within the Muslim world is a divine obligation that is embedded in the fabric of the Quran. And they declared that this is something that is essential and necessary in order for the Muslim world to reverse the decades of Western imperialist occupation and extortion of Muslim land. And the one of the speakers mentioned today that Yemen will always stand with any Islamic resistance against the Western hegemonic international structure. They believe that the U.S. and other Western nations are hell-bent on extortion of the Muslim world and occupying Muslim lands, and this is something that cannot, that will only be reversed and will only come to an end once there is unification between the Muslims, and you know, they call for unification of Muslim movements, unification of Muslim armies, and the Ansar Allah movement is basically willing to take play a central role in leading to this unification within the Muslim armies, within the Muslim world. And that was a common theme that was echoed throughout this Ashura commemoration.
Okay, Yusuf, this is Ashura, and you know, Muslims, no matter where they are, like in Yemen, Palestine, Iran, whatever else they are in the Western world, they are remembering Imam Hussein and what he did and his cause and his uprising. and the message that he had for us, and he tried to bring justice and also revive Islam. So let us have a little bit of elaboration on what it has to do with, on such an occasion, people in Yemen, you yourself and people there, they're identifying themselves with, on such a day, on Ashura, I mean, with what's happening and the goings-on in Yemen and in the Palestinian occupied territories. What is it that makes you identify with the Palestinians?
Well, interesting enough, you know, the revolution in Yemen, as was declared from day one, is basically the continuation of the revolution of Imam Hussein in his struggle and during his revolution in Karbala. So they view what's happening in Yemen and the war in Yemen as just a continuation of the revolution of Imam Hussein. And because it is such a revolution that's on the path of Imam Hussein, it has to stick to certain guidelines that align with Islamic principles and Islamic values, such one of which is, if any Muslim in the world is under oppression, then it is the obligation of the people who are, or the followers of Imam Hussein, to support that Muslim group or that Muslim nation that is under occupation or that is in need of support. And so, you know, from what I heard today at the commemoration was that this revolution needs to be in line with the principles and the values that Imam Hussein stood for in Karbala and the rest of his household. And this is what they are calling for the rest of the Muslim world to embrace the revolution of Karbala, to embrace the struggles of Imam Hussein so that the Muslim world can revive as a whole and reverse the decades of Western domination over Muslim lands. And that is a message, according to Ansar Allah and according to a lot of Yemenis that I spoke with, this is something that bothers and irritates the likes of Saudi Arabia and the likes of the Emirati rulers. They do not like the message of Imam Hussein, according to the speakers today. They stand for everything against the revolution of Imam Hussein, and this is why Yemen is engulfed and Palestine is engulfed in this conflict whereby you have all these nations, you have all these Western powers declaring war on those who choose to live their life in accordance with Islam, those who choose to live their life in accordance with the Quran. The Quran, according to Ansarullah movement, does not accept humiliation, right? And I think one of the main themes or one of the main slogans that was chanted today here in at the protest was, never to humiliation. And this was a famous quote that was uttered by Imam Hussein before his martyrdom in Karbala.
Exactly. All right. Thank you so much for that, Yusuf Mauri, Yemeni activist and political analyst who joined us from Sana'a. Now, a convoy of fuel trucks has entered Gaza Strip hours after Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to a ceasefire with the Tel Aviv regime. The fuel was delivered through the southern crossing into besieged territory, and that after 3 days of Israeli air raids and retaliatory attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The fighting was triggered by an Israeli strike that assassinated the leader of the Palestinian resistance movement in Gaza on Friday. The aggression killed 45 Palestinians, including 15 children. It wounded 360 other people. Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad movement has lauded Palestinian people's resistance against Israeli aggression, saying that all resistance groups are a united front. Ziad al-Nakhala said that Palestinian resistance groups will remain steadfast and determined in their confrontation against the Zionist regime. He said resistance groups have been firing rockets at Israeli targets in retaliation for the regime's acts of aggression. He noted that Palestinian people and the resistance front have secured achievements in their fight against the Tel Aviv regime. The Islamic Jihad leaders said that the resistance front has set conditions for an Egyptian brokered truce to enter into effect, including the release of two of its prisoners. Nakhala added that the resistance front managed to force its conditions on Israel. He also thanked Iran for supporting the Palestinian nation. Nakhala made those comments in a presser held following announcement of a truce which ended Israel's latest bloody onslaught against the Gaza Strip. Now here are the reactions of the people in Gaza to Israel's deadly airstrikes against their besieged territory.
The house was overcrowded with no less than 22 members, and around it there were six houses that were all damaged. And this happened without a warning. It was horrifying. They targeted the house with five or six rockets. There were body parts on the ground. It's horrifying.
They target people. They target helpless people who are safe in their homes. They target children and old people. They do not have mercy. Who can we complain to?
This building has three apartments, shops including smithy shop, aluminum shop, a carpenter shop, a fish store, chicken store. This is a tragedy. We appeal to the Arab countries and Muslims to stand with us.
In other news, the Secretary General of Hezbollah movement says that retaliatory attacks by the resistance front against Israel prevented the regime from performing more acts of aggression. Sadassan Nasrallah made the comment in a televised address referring to truce that took effect between Israel and the Islamic Jihad movement in the Gaza Strip. Nasrallah said it was clear that the Zionist enemy was trying to stop the conflict because it could not take more retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. He added that Israel's conditions did not allow the regime to continue its military aggression against Gaza. Nasrallah also praised Palestinian people's determination in their struggle against Israel. The Hezbollah leader said that resistance groups are strong enough to impose their conditions on the Zionist enemy. Now, Iran has strongly condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities by a small group in the German city of Hamburg. Foreign Ministry spokesman says the blasphemous act that took place outside the Islamic Center of Hamburg is a clear example of sedition and hate-mongering. Nasser Kanani warned against dangerous consequences of such seditious and insulting moves, saying they're another face of Takfiri and Daesh-like violence and extremism. He said governments that claim to be advocating freedom and human rights must oppose such moves. He also urged the German government to take immediate, strong, and explicit measures against those making such insulting moves, including through rapid judicial action. Kanani said that the global arrogance and Zionism are behind those seditious acts. He urged Muslims and Islamic countries to form a united front in the face of plots hatched by the enemies of Islam. Well, that's a wrap.
His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. His cradle is empty, his body is bloody, his body is bloody. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. My face is colored by the blood of my son, by the blood of my son. My face is colored by the blood of my son, by the blood of my son. I saw him in a huge fire kindled inside me. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. I saw him in a huge fire kindled inside me. Oh, mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. I lost him here, but I lost him, but here's my honor. I lost him, but here's my honor. The one infant, a great hero. The one infant, a great hero. He supported his father when he was surrounded by much sorrow. He supported his father when He was surrounded by much sorrow, old tent dwellers all. Now in a big grief, now in a big grief, old tent dwellers all. Now in a big grief, now in a big grief. Tents are burning of both my sides and fire of enemy. O mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. Tents are burning of both my sides and fire of enemy. O mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty. O mothers, my innocent son was killed hungry and thirsty.
What you just heard was a lamentation for Chief of Martyrs Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, performed at Tehran University Mosque by members of the Saradlah Group of Mourners of Tehran University Medical School.
The Uber files has been released, and it looks more like a rap sheet than anything else, from tax dodging to lobbying diplomats and foreign dignitaries to price manipulation. And from what we did at this Economic Divide program, this may involve dodgy financial accounting reporting. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. Welcome to Economic Divide. Today's program is about the Uber files. Some of the topics that we'll be covering in today's program: the Uber leaks. It was reported that they broke laws, they duped police, and they exploited violence against drivers. Just some of the things that the Uber leaks revealed. Another highlight of the program, the strategy behind Uber. It undercut tax-free markets, it lobbied for new laws in order to protect them, and it also paved the way for the Uber application to be installed with the general masses. Of course, that produced controversies within itself. And finally, Uber friends, politicians, and barons, they acted against their own citizens. That is the cost of being friends with Uber.
Uber is a tech giant that provides mobility services globally. It allows users to book a car and a driver for transportation. Its services also include food delivery, package delivery, couriers, and freight transportation. The company is based in San Francisco, with operations in approximately 72 countries and 10,500 cities. Over the years, it has come to be known as a reliable service, with 118 million monthly active users worldwide. With 19 million trips per day, it generated over $17.4 billion in revenues in 2021. But Uber's success is not only due to the creativity and ingenuity of its founders.
In short, digital platforms have massive potential. They offer working flexibility, they create jobs, bring innovation, and cater for what is clearly a strong consumer demand. However, people are the heart of this business model. They deserve the same protection and conditions as any other worker in any EU country, including access to collective bargaining and representation.
Uber technology, as it is called, is known to be a ride-sharing application, among other things. But the funny thing about this company is that there's more negative material out there than positive information on it. Then came the Uber files, and boom, that just pushed the controversies over the top. These are some of the things that people have said online about the company. First, to rig the marketplace so a company with $20 billion in financing but no actual competitive advantages could destroy operators who were willing to obey existing laws but had much less financing. Our next tweet comes from Chile, or on Chile, which says, following Italy trying to bring down the government, taxi drivers protest against Uber licenses and the price of fuel. The Uber files prove that WEF connections allowed them to fund trading at a loss to force small businesses out of business. Well, talk about Italians. They are saying no to human beings' modern slavery. as it's been described, which is an oppression to drivers by Uber. And finally, we needed to take a look at the Uber files itself in terms of how it was described by the whistleblower who came forward, where it said, as a title, "We sold people a lie."
My name is Mark McGann. I'm a former senior executive at Uber, and I'm here as a whistleblower. I'm the one who revealed what's become known as the Uber files. I'd worked in highly stressful environments before. Uber was very different. It was very intense. Threats, violence, death threats on social media. And it's only when you come off that kind of hamster wheel and you take a step back that you realize how crazy it all was.
Ouch, that's gotta hurt. That's how this has been described. Let's introduce our guests, though, and see what they think. Sergio Avedian is a senior contributor at the Rideshare Guy who joins us. Sergio Avedian, welcome. Looking at this ride-sharing application by the name of Uber, it has its enemies not only within the U.S. but outside the U.S. The expansion that took place across the world was rather phenomenal, where hundreds of leaders in dozens of countries were courted. It included, obviously, politicians. But didn't the politicians act with regards to Uber in a way that it sacrificed their own citizens?
It obviously did, right? So all the existing cab companies, let's say, because when Uber first showed up, they showed up as a disruptor. Disruptor meaning they wanted to revolutionize public and personal transportation, which they have done. In some cases, obviously, not that the documents show, illegally, and in some cases, risking the lives of their own drivers. While we know what happened as far as in Europe is concerned, as well as the United States, that cab companies were not happy about this because Uber, is not a regulated company. While cab industry in all over the world is regulated industry by the local and state authorities.
All right, let's bring in Professor Joe Haslam and see what he thinks. We welcome him, Executive Director of the Owners Scale Up Program at IE Business School in Madrid, Spain. Professor Joe Haslam, welcome to Economic Divide. Uber followed some unscrupulous business ethics, to say the least, in which taxi and cab markets were put under pressure. Governments were pushed to rewrite laws, and also we're looking at an app-based gig economy model of work that has since proliferated across the world. What is there to say that this is not going to happen in other industries within those countries who are, in essence, harming its workers?
Yeah, it's a great question, but the issue is, of course, is that the fun will continue until the money runs out, and a lot of these gig economy companies, these apps, super apps, whatever you want to call them, have been funded by venture capital. The idea that you invest for growth instead of profit, and that you drive out all competitions and then raise prices. However, we're now at a period at the end of cheap money where it's not going to be possible anymore to fund these companies indefinitely. So I think there would have been a problem if we weren't at the end of cheap money, but I think the situation will sort itself out.
But the fact that Uber's IPO was not the success story that it should have been isn't really about the fundamentals of the company today. It's more about the fact that their valuation got too high too fast in the past, and that severely constrained their ability to set a fair price for their IPO when they went public.
It's time now for the info news section of the program. Our first item surely will catch your attention, and it is about something that actually relates to the Ukraine conflict. It's called deglobalization. That's right. World economy at risk of deglobalization based on what the IMF has said. Now, Russia's military operation in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Moscow, well, they might push the global economy into geopolitical fragmentation. That's kind of a dark side scenario that is another consequence of the Ukraine conflict. Next up, Kenya. Kenya's economy is our focus in this particular post that we brought out for you. Debt shadow clouds Kenya's forthcoming presidential polls. So obviously, as usual, the economy is what drives a poll or an election in this case. Kenya's economy at this point is Africa's sixth biggest, but its debt is up to two-thirds of the GDP. So debt plaguing Kenya is obviously a big burden on the economy there, not to mention other countries in Africa. Our next post is very dangerous in terms of the unity of Europe as a whole. That is our focus, where Europe's fight to stay united over the war in Ukraine, that's actually is being put to the test. That has been going on for some time. Now, Europe as a whole is now forced to wrestle with soaring inflation. We know that. The bloc is not as united as it seems. And we are seeing, obviously, the gas stoppage from Russia, which has amounted to quite a bit, especially for a country like Germany, to break this unity at this point, which seems to be inevitable in some senses. Next up, we go to the United States, a pact by the name of Schumer and Manchin. It's a tax and spending deal that they call the Inflation Reduction Act, in which new taxes and price controls to pay for green corporate welfare for the politically favored is the focus. Now, the question that many are asking is their aim to reduce inflation by chilling business investments and the economy? So obviously there's hidden factors that others are seeing in this pact between the two. Those were the ones that we picked in terms of news for you with the flavor of the economy in it. Of course, we would appreciate it if you... Hello and welcome to our in-depth section. Uber as a company has been filled with controversies, no doubt about that. Now, aside from these controversies, in this in-depth section, we actually wanted to find out if Uber was profitable or not. I mean, that's a simple approach here, but yet a very important one. In other words, was it making money or was it still incurring losses? Well, we found out even that is a challenge in itself. For example, in the year 2019, this is what the company actually reported. The headline read, how can a company lose $5.2 billion in revenues of $3.2 billion? Uber is going to show you how. $5.2 billion in revenues, $3.2 billion is what actually came out of that in terms of losses. Now, that is the question that comes to mind. How can the company actually lose $5.2 billion when the revenues were only $3.2 billion? Now, breaking that down is actually very hard, and digesting it is actually harder, but here is what the profit and loss comes into view for the operation of Uber. We went back all the way to the year 2014 and then went all the way to the year 2019. The ones in the blue are the profits. The ones in the red are the losses. The thing is, Uber reported sales of only $3.2 billion. In other words, the net loss actually exceeded, again, sales by $2 billion. The loss of $5.24 billion added to the loss of $878 million in the first quarter. So overall, Uber lost $6.25 billion in the first half of 2019. Total revenue for the two quarters was $6.3 billion. All right, next up, let's fast forward to November 2021. Another shocking headlines, in this case in point, we're going to tell you what that means. Uber reports a loss, even as revenue jumped 72%, $5.9 billion losses, from three of their other operations that they just splashed money onto, Diddy Global, Grab Holdings, and Aurora. Again, $5.2 billion in losses. The revenues jumped, according to them, 72%. But thanks to its $3.2 billion loss in those three ventures, that was called the write-down. The amount, again, $5.2 billion. It said that this loss was due to unrealized losses from these stakes that I just mentioned. So there you have another headline where the numbers just don't add up in terms of the conclusion that is being reached. Now, we then proceeded actually to look at the figures from the actual books at Uber in terms of its profit and loss statements. Well, this is what we found out. Uber's fourth quarter and full year results for the year 2021, very recent, gross bookings at $25.9 billion. That's up 72% year over year. Net income recorded $892 million, which is almost $1 billion. That's the actual figures that is the most current that we had based on what Uber actually reported, which projected a gross bookings of, as we mentioned, $25.9 billion with a net income of $892 million. Now, let's move on to the company's CEO, Mr. Khosrow Shahi. That's right, he's Iranian origin. He has said that Uber's driver base is, from what he has said, at a post-pandemic high. To explain some of the high figures, or the profitability projection. And he said that it expects engagement to continue without significant incremental incentive investments. He has to say that. See, people have to realize that because he has to show that there's momentum in the money that Uber is making. And also, at the same time, explain the loss, but that it's moving forward in terms of the money that the company is actually making. If you didn't understand that, that's okay. Let me bring in Sergio Avedin. He's the senior contributor who rejoins us at the rideshare guy. All right, Sergio Avedin, welcome back to Economic Divide. We are looking at this leaked trove of confidential files. Lots of revelations there. It flouted the laws. It duped police. Things that you're very much familiar with. At this point, why was there such a drive then behind Uber to go to these lengths to offer a service which sounds like it shouldn't be so intricate when it comes to a ride-sharing application? What are your thoughts on that?
Thanks for having me on. I'm from the first day, actually, all the way to today, Uber doesn't call itself a rideshare company to start with. That's just a word that just came around. They call themselves a technology company. So the reason for that is because they have been breaking the local city and state and federal laws, labor laws, transportation laws from their inception. So to me, you know, this is not that much of a surprise. These documents have been floating around for a while. I've known about these documents for a while. You know, look, they have to do what they have to do. You know, they went to lengths of breaking laws, obviously, and lobbying efforts. And as we know, in politics today, lobbying is in every issue is very strong. I'm not condoning what they did, but they were also trying to protect close to 50, 60, at some point, $100 billion worth of market capitalization.
All right, thank you very much, Sergio Avedin. Perhaps he gave us a bit of a background behind the numbers that we just covered. All right, let's bring back Mr. Joe Haslam, Executive Director at Owner Scale Up Program, who rejoins us from Madrid, Spain. Welcome back, Joe Haslam. We're trying to find out an explanation behind the numbers that Uber has offered, behind the way that the company has acted in terms of not only its operations, but also in terms of the aggressive global expansion that it has gone through. How do you explain the way that Uber has acted, and why has it gone through such lengths to offer what appears to be a ride-sharing application?
No, a lot of this comes down to the Silicon Valley philosophy of rugged individualism, much of which comes from Andrew Ryan, who's a philosopher who wrote books like The Fountainhead. They kind of believe that existing structures hold back progress. I mean, if you talk to Silicon Valley, the cliche is often, you know, we're changing the world, we're making the world a better place. And it isn't until after they've left these companies that they start to see the destruction they've left. So while in the beginning, everyone sort of talks to the people, talks to the authorities, very quickly they get frustrated and they change their approach, which is let's just launch and see what happens. I mean, Facebook called this move fast and break things, but it's the same philosophy that applies in Uber. So they have a playbook whereby they go to a city and then they just start launching the application. And then they hope that they can get enough support from the public that the politicians then won't shut down the service.
Massive corruption involving Uber and its dirty practices have now emerged that show the company's success was not really down to standard business practices. The case, which has come to be known as the Uber Files and involves more than 124,000 company files, has shed light on the unscrupulous methods used by the company. The files, which are from the period 2013 to 2017, include correspondence, emails, company presentations, and text messages to elected officials.
One of the officials who was secretly consulted by Uber for illegal business advantages was Emmanuel Macron, the then economy minister of France in the government of former President François Hollande. Uber cut a secret deal with Macron to help the company get away with tight regulations of the sector, seen with the current CEO of Uber, Dara Khosrowshahi. So what were those secrets? This is what Ramin Mazohiri, our correspondent in Paris, said.
Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code.
Let's break down what Uber is actually guilty of here. The secret deals that involved Macron and Uber were as follows. The goal, to undermine laws created to regulate Uber safety, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the National Labor Code. Macron also helped Uber consolidate its position in France. The company also approached other top politicians, including then-US Vice President Joe Biden and George Osborne, the UK's former Chancellor of Exchequer. Apart from cutting secret deals with politicians, Uber is also accused of jeopardizing the livelihoods of many people. In some cities, Uber initially paid nearly 90% of drivers' hourly earnings in order to drive out competitors. That was essentially giving rides for free, which sent taxi drivers into economic despair. And finally, the controversy which drew the most attention from the drivers was the issue of employment status. Rideshare services Uber and Lyft defended their business model, fighting a law requiring them to reclassify their drivers as employees. The law requires businesses in the gig economy to reclassify independent contractors as employees eligible for unemployment coverage, medical, and other benefits, something both Lyft and another ride-sharing app and Uber have categorically refused to do. Here's one demo that took place in front of the Uber headquarters in San Francisco back in 2020.
All these companies, they're paying under a minimum wage. Protections that people fought for generations prior to this are getting tossed out the window under the language of freelance or flexibility. But if you can't pay someone minimum wage to do their job, you shouldn't have a company.
Why I'm saying no to 22 is because it doesn't do enough. It's really a facade by the companies to try to maintain their profits, to stay in the black instead of the red, and that comes at our expense.
The Uber Files is an example of how cheap money funneled in an extravagant IPO flooded the company with cash, which was unable to venture out into other arenas. Now, whether those other arenas were successful or not, that's a whole other story. However, in the process, politicians were courted and they were lobbied in order to make way for this business. Surprised? You shouldn't be. This is what's called capitalism at its best. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Mikove Tafai and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
واحد دشنه بر لب تشنه بر لب تشنه بر لب تشنه
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry, water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
I cry.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at humanity through Ashura and the uprising and revolution of Imam al-Hussein alayhi al-salam. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he refused to give bay'ah to Yazid, obviously the only option was for Yazid is to get rid of Imam al-Hussein in any possible way, even if it means killing him. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he understood that Yazid will stop at nothing, he took his family and he left Medina. Obviously to Mecca, from Mecca to Iraq, to Karbala. Now, this itself, a message for humanity in terms of human rights. We said in the previous episode that me and you, our job and our role is to reject and stop against and defy any system, any taghuti system, any oppressive system, when they try to make me a new part of it. We need to stand firm and say no. Sometimes, saying no is not an option as well. People on these systems will not accept no for an answer. They want complete submission, which means you have to take measures yourself to make sure you do not become part or supporter of these taghuti systems, these oppressive systems that takes the rights of people, just like Imam Hussein alayhi salam did. And the first option that we have is to speak our minds. If we find out that speaking our minds will get us in Guantanamo Bay or get us into prison or at least under house arrest, as happens to many Muslims around the world in these oppressive systems, then sometimes the only option is to leave, because I and you do not want to take part in shedding the blood of innocent people or taking the rights of innocent people that will be done by the systems that we support. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he moved from Medina. He said, okay, I can't be in Medina, because if I have to be there, I have to give my allegiance, but I can move. I can take my family and change my direction, go somewhere else. And he did. And he did that for the sake of what? For his own sake? He could have been saved. He could have not even give allegiance and say, well, look, I'm not going to give allegiance and I'm just going to mind my own business. He could have done that and he could have been saved. But he refused. He had to make a statement to the world that I need to make sure that everyone lives a happy, dignified life, and I will not allow people like Yazid to take charge. Me and you, we have to make the exact same move. So if you find yourself stuck in a taghuti system, in an oppressive system, and you're not giving them your allegiance, But sometimes you're staying there, working for them, and paying their taxes, doing everything by the book, abiding by the laws, respecting the laws even. Because now in many parts of the world where LGBT became part of the law, you have to respect all the LGBT members. Obviously, that's itself is a disaster. So having to respect it is a form of agreeing with it. So how do you deal with this case? Well, obviously, you need to leave. Let us take a short break, and then we will continue this discussion.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you're listening to the program for humanity. Just before the break, we were saying that Imam Hussein left Medina to Mecca to Iraq because he did not want to participate or take part of the new regime and the new system led by Yazid. Me and you, sometimes we have to make the same move. And most people that I've spoken to who live in the Western countries and live in oppressive systems, when I say to them, well, you need to move because you staying there is a form of supporting it. You migrating to it is a form of supporting it. If you're a doctor there, if you're an engineer there, or if you're a teacher there, it's a form of support whether you like it or not. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. So you need to move. And most people say, well, I don't have money. I don't have the finances. I don't have this. I don't have that to move. Well, look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Did he have anything when he left? No, he just took his wife and his children and his kids and he just moved. With nothing, he left everything behind for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for the sake of mankind. He left everything behind. Now, which is more pure? My blood, your blood, or the blood of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the blood of his children and the blood of his companions? Obviously, you will say, well, it's their blood. Then how come Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he gave his blood and the blood of his family so cheap for the sake of Islam without complaining, without saying what if, without saying why, without saying anything? He just moved. And he knew the consequences of his action. He knew he will be slaughtered. He himself said, you know, I can see that my body parts being torn apart by the wolves of the desert between Asqalan and Karbala. He told us that before he moved. And he knew he was going to get killed. But he said, I'd rather die with my dignity and save myself and save those around me and my family and their dignity and their rights rather than live under an oppressive system. So me and you, because we love this world so much, we come up with excuses. Oh, I don't have the money. Oh, what if it's not safe for me there? Oh, what about my children? What about the education of my children? These countries are backwards. These are this. No, I would rather stay here. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala understand. I'm not doing anything haram. I'm praying. I'm fasting. We're constantly justifying our actions just so we could stay under these oppressive systems. And because these oppressive systems, they have decorated themselves with human rights and justice and what have you, and they seem to be free countries and countries that take care of you, but they're not. It's just a decoration. It's just, as the Quran calls it, zina. Right? الشيطان زين لهم أعمالهم. He beautified their actions for them. But is it really true? It's not. Why is it not true? Because the same people that we live under their systems, they are the ones who are killing us and killing Muslims and depriving Muslims of every right that they have. So me and you, we have to make the sacrifice for human rights, just like Imam Hussein did, at whatever cost it might come with. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.